This land is yours, this land is mine, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water, this land was made for you.
And welcome to the People Speak Radio. This is your host, David Swanson, and we are privileged to have with us as a guest for the next hour, former senator from the state of Rhode Island, Lincoln Chafee. Senator, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me on the show.
We are thrilled to do it, and I have read a copy of your new book, Against the Tide, which is an account, among other things, of your time in the United States Senate from 1999 to 2006, and your subtitle is quite interesting and makes a point in itself that many serving Congress members are reluctant to make, and that is that the title of the book is Against the Tide, How a Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President. Can you suggest what you mean by that?
Well, the Founding Fathers set up the Congress when they wrote the Constitution to check a rogue executive, and they were very, very fearful of, obviously, of monarchs, and so they were very careful about setting up a legislative body to check and balance the executive branch, and particularly the United States Senate, where they gave us six-year terms so that two-thirds of us would not be up for election in any one given moment. Highly emotional moment. They specifically designed for what happened when Bush Cheney came in, and it didn't work. My fellow colleagues, many of them, were not willing to stand up and check these two aggressive personalities at the top of the executive branch, Bush and Cheney.
One of the ways that the Senate can check a president is by approving or not approving nominees. And as well as treaties and other things. And there's an account in your book of John Bolton, who George Bush nominated to be our ambassador to the United Nations, despite his passionate hatred for the organization of the United Nations. Can you describe what happened? Because initially you took one position and then you took a different one. How did that play out?
Yes, the President Bush nominated John Bolton to be UN ambassador after he won his second term, so that would probably be the spring of 2005. And I was a Republican senator, and I differed from the president on many issues in the administration, environmental issues, on pro-choice issues, on drilling in the Arctic Refuge. I voted one of only two Republicans to vote against the tax cuts, the only Republican to vote against the war authorization. But one rule I had was that I would support his nominees unless there were really overwhelming evidence, such as ethical evidence or criminal evidence or the like. That was one rule I had because I'd been mayor of my city, and I had a Democratic city council that always was trying to not allow me to appoint members of my administration, having to horse trade in order to get some of my directors placed. So I had that local experience, and it was the one thing I could say to my Republicans back here in Rhode Island, that one area that I supported President Bush, and I did that with some expense to me when I supported John Ashcroft, for instance, to Attorney General, and Gail Norton to the Interior. Those were controversial early in Bush's Cheney's administration. And so I tried to keep that as unqualified as John Bolton was to be our top diplomat. And ultimately, so in a committee, on the Foreign Relations Committee, I did cast an aye vote. As it turned out, Senator Voinovich from Ohio surprised everybody by saying he couldn't vote for him. And President Bush made John Bolton a recess appointment, what they call a recess appointment. And
then the second time around,
recess, excuse me?
it gets around the Senate's power to check the president, correct?
Yes, yes. And it's in the Constitution that if the Senate's not in session, the president can make an appointment. And he did that with John Bolton. But it expires at the end of a certain amount of time. And the second time around, I did vote against or declined to vote for Bolton. And the president pulled him.
And that was
no longer UN ambassador.
Yeah, well, that's an accomplishment right there. Let me tell our listeners, Senator, how they can get in on this conversation. This is the People Speak Radio, and our guest is former Senator from Rhode Island, Lincoln Chafee. You can call in and join us with your questions toll-free from anywhere in the United States and Canada at 888-228-4494. That's 888-228-4494. Anywhere else in the world, use 877-489-6350. It's a wonderful account, this book, Against the Tide, and it's quite a journey from the 2000 presidential campaign, during which you recount that you believed the hype. You believed what Bush and Cheney were talking about during the campaign of compassionate conservatism, uniting the country. And then the day after the Supreme Court stops the vote recount in Florida, the vice president-elect has a meeting with you and a handful of Senate moderates and kind of takes a different approach. Can you describe that sequence of events?
Yes, there were five moderate Republicans that had lunch every Wednesday. Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania, Olympia Snow from Maine, Susan Collins from Maine, Jim Jeffords was still a Republican, and myself, every Wednesday, very loyally, and we'd invited the candidate for vice president to join us, Richard Cheney, and we didn't know that the Supreme Court was going to rule on a Tuesday night, and they ruled, and he joined us the next day, just hours after being minted as a new vice president, and at that lunch, he spelled out this radical agenda, big tax cuts, getting out of international agreements. And as you said in your question, they had run on being united, not as dividers. And Governor Bush, the candidate, had said he'd have a humble foreign policy. I remember that during the debates. We'll have a humble foreign policy. And here, right from the first minute, they're saying we're going to be arrogant and we're going to be divisive, contrary to what they promised the American people. And there's a cliche about falling off your chair. At that lunch, I almost fell off my chair. Number one, how could a vice president be telling us this? If we're hearing it from the president, that would be one thing. This is the vice president telling us they're going to rip up all their campaign promises. And then the second thing, David, my fellow moderates weren't saying that's not going to happen. The Senate was 50-50, 50 Democrats, 50 Republicans. We had five of us at that table, five moderate Republicans. We could have said, with all due respect, Mr. Vice President-elect, that's not going to happen. We're not going to agree with that. There's five votes here. And if we team up with the Democrats, you won't get it. And I didn't hear that from my colleagues. And that was, and I knew what was at stake. I could clearly foresee the direction that they now wanted to take the country. And I was sickened by it.
This
was all before September 11th. Everyone says everything changed in September. No. Right off the bat, they were divisive and arrogant.
And you were not the highest in seniority, so you didn't get to reply first to the vice president-elect or select. And Senator Specter had that role. And in your account, neither he nor any of your colleagues challenged the vice president's agenda in the least. And when you attempted to, he sort of brushed you off and said it didn't matter. They were going to do what they wanted. What do you think caused your colleagues not to challenge the vice president?
You're right. Even at a lunch, an informal lunch, we still go by seniority. And so Senator Specter had the seniority in asking questions. And I was shocked that he, right off the bat, he wasn't saying, with all due respect, being cordial and respectful, but just raising a point that we've been through impeachment with President Clinton. We've had Gingrich and Clinton fighting, and the Republicans have just lost 5 seats in the Senate, making 50-50. We lost Bill Roth from Delaware, Slade Gorton from the state of Washington, John Ashcroft had lost in Missouri. It's significant when incumbents lose, and yet here we are wading right into another divisive agenda, and just what the country didn't need at that time. And us moderates, we didn't flex our muscles. My colleagues, I have no good answers as to why not. And maybe just being in the same, there's only the 6 of us, the 5 moderates and the vice president, maybe the aura of the new vice president-elect tempered their better judgment. I don't have a good answer.
Yes.
I certainly tried to question them. I came last. I was the most junior. And I said, it's 50-50 Senate. You're going to need our votes. And he said, every vote's important, and moved on. And I just was hoping that later we'd be able to rally the moderates and say, and stick together and say, we're not going to agree with this. We've got to get this country on the right track.
And apparently that wasn't possible, and we've been moving down the wrong track, as I know you agree, for a number of years now.
Yes, and it started with the big tax cut, David, and that was before September 11th. The first big fight we had in the Senate was a $1.6 trillion tax cut, and my fellow moderates all voted for it.
That was
the time to check them, to check Bush-Cheney, right off the bat. Don't let them get ahead of steam.
It's interesting that you describe that fight as the initial sort of disempowering of Congress, turning Congress from a fully empowered first branch of our government into sort of irrelevant court jesters to the White House, which has all the power. How is it that the tax cut battle had that impact?
Let me put it in perspective. We had worked so hard for surpluses, and I can remember just following politics back in the 80s, something called Graham-Rudman. It was a big deal trying to wrestle with these deficits. And then H.W. Bush said, read my lips, no new taxes. He had to go back on that pledge because the deficits kept getting deeper. And then Ross Perot had his charts. I mean, deficits were the big thing. And we finally got them under control and had surpluses. And President Clinton, who I served under for a year, had vetoed in October a Republican-passed bill of $400 billion in tax cuts. And so this is a 1.6 the Bush-Cheney administration were proposing just months later, in January and February, a $1.6 trillion tax cut. Clinton had vetoed a 0.4, if you are following me, $400 billion. He vetoed it as being too deep and irresponsible and jeopardizing our surplus. But the whole objective of Bush-Cheney were exactly as you said, to disempower Congress. And the best way to do it is to serve up what every politician wants to do, is cut taxes. That's popular. But the point was, I'm sure, let's make Congress irrelevant. We run the show. The executive branch runs the show. And we're going to put in 1.5, 1.6, 1.7, the number wasn't important. Just they know it's wrong, but make it so politically irresistible that we no longer have to, they no longer, well, they have any power and no longer any backbone.
That's my theory.
I
think it's solidly been proven now 7 years later, but at the time, very few of us imagined exactly how far this administration would go, but a lot of us didn't believe the compassionate conservatism, unite the country nonsense for a minute, and we'd read the accounts by Molly Ivins and Lou Dubose from how the president had behaved in Texas. What percentage of the public do you think believed the hype during the campaign and were shocked when the president came in? Because I have to say, I wasn't shocked. I've been gradually outraged at the extent of the abuse of power that I never expected, but I wasn't shocked by the general agenda.
Yes, that's good, David. As I look back on it, certainly having his father, who was a good president, now historic, as history looks back at him, George H.W. Bush, not perfect, but David Souter to the Supreme Court was a good nomination. Certainly, Clarence Thomas is debatable, but did many good things. As I said, went back on that Read My Lips pledge in order to tackle the deficit. So you had that factor to the Bush candidacy. And then can someone just look in the camera and lie so baldly that we're going to have a humble foreign policy when the first day it's going to be the absolute opposite, and talk about in every single speech I'm going to unite the country in a breath of fresh air, a new atmosphere in Washington, a bald-faced 180-degree lie? That was hard to fathom. But as you said, you did have the South Carolina primaries. That was nagging at who these people were and what the real agenda was. And so I was on my guard, certainly, when they went back on their campaign pledges right away, and that's why I voted against the tax cuts. I'm one of only two Republicans.
One of only two to vote against those tax cuts, and the only Republican in the Senate to vote against the authorization to attack Iraq, showing better judgment than quite a number of Democrats that day. I'd like to start bringing some callers in on this conversation, because people are going to have a lot of questions for former Senator Lincoln Chafee, and you can join us from anywhere in the U.S. and Canada at 888-228-4494. Steve from Santa Fe is on the line. Steve, thanks for calling the People Speak Radio.
Thank you for taking my call, David. Senator Chafee, thank you. And thank you for the way you voted against war and all of that. You know, I do have a question, and it's going to be a little pointed. We all, I think, know about, not that to take away from your book by any means, but at this point in time, we all know about Cheney and Bush and all of them and how horrible they are. I mean, they're torturing people. They're spying on their own citizens. What can we do about it? I mean, if the Democrats, which is supposed to be the liberal end of all of this, is doing nothing, and a handful of you Republicans are doing something, what can we do to change that? It's the most important thing. I mean, we have become the enemy our fathers fought against. And I'll listen online. Thank you.
Great, Steve. Yes. Well, we all know how bad they are, but I think my book really does have some unique perspective, because I was a Republican who was consistently voting against them. And so in my book, I think you will enjoy reliving the years that got us to where we were today, to where we are today, and my book Against the Tide. I really do, Steve, think you'll like it. And what can we do now? I have disaffiliated from the Republican Party, and I'm a strong backer of Senator Obama. I served with him for 2 years in the Senate and on two committees, and I've watched him run his campaign and his message and his vision for the country, and he's the candidate that can begin the repair work that's so important. And the most important thing he said the other day was, we need to tell the truth consistently and defiantly. And that is absolutely right. That's what it's going to take to repair the damage of Bush Cheney. Consistently and defiantly telling the truth on everything. And those are Obama's words. And I think that's the most important thing we can do, restore our credibility at home and abroad.
Well, I second the recommendation of the book. It is an excellent insight into what happens in the Senate and in the Congress and in Washington from the point of view of someone who's trying to resist a town that's going insane. But I wonder, Senator Chafee, about the step that the Constitution seems to make so prominent and important in times like these, that isn't as much talked about in Washington as refusing to approve of nominees and to consent to treaties and so forth, and that is, of course, impeachment. One would think that if a president openly spies in violation of the law and tortures and detains without charge and violates laws and openly rewrites laws with signing statements and all the rest of it, we would have long since surpassed that level of high crime and misdemeanor that we reached with a guy lying about a sexual affair. We need truth telling. We need it in the media. We need it in books. But don't we need it in Congress too?
Yes, it's phenomenal that, as you said, that one president can be impeached for lying about an affair, and another can consistently prevaricate on every issue and dodge that same fate. And all I can say is that they've been brilliant at using September 11th, just brilliant at using it to rally the country around the dismantling of so many of our freedoms here, as spelled out in the Constitution. And everything's been wrapped around patriotism and the fight and the battle, and they've just been very, very adept at, with orange alerts and red alerts, at raising the fear and dividing the country as they go about their agenda. And then, of course, you did have the unfortunate trial of President Clinton, just so fresh that a lot of members of the Congress just did not want to do that again so soon after the last one. That was a factor in Bush Cheney's favor. And, of course, you would have to impeach them both. You don't want to impeach one and have the other.
Sure.
Those are a number of factors.
No, I couldn't agree more. Just like you had to get Agnew before Nixon, you would need to get Cheney first. But you bring up 9/11, and it's rather stunning in your book, the account. You were one of the few members of the Senate or the House willing to go so far as to wonder and think about what might have motivated the criminals who attacked those buildings on 9/11, which ought to have been automatic for every single American, but was apparently taboo and verboten, and yet you did it, and you seemed not to be following the taboos. I mean, you said that they were not going to find weapons of mass destruction. We have, I just read a book by another Congress member, Robert Wexler, who's quite a courageous man and quite a liberal, who claims that he believed the hype and thought there were weapons of mass destruction. You were among those saying, nope, you're not going to find them. Why were you willing to speak out, and why were so many people not?
You just have to recall the trauma of the Twin Towers coming down, the heap of dust, and that made a lot of people angry. Anger's a powerful emotion. And hitting the Pentagon, and of course the Pennsylvania flight, all this happening, just Americans were an angry people at that time, and clouded so much judgment. I myself had thought that at this moment in history, when Bush Cheney came in, we had surpluses, and the Cold War had ended. We kind of moved on beyond Vietnam. We had a moment in history that was very, very precious. And I didn't trust these two people to handle this moment in history wisely. And just what they showed me prior to September 11th, you can't trust them. And I even voted against initially in the days after September 11th. I think September 11th was a Tuesday, and we met to give the president authorization to respond on a Thursday, which ended up being Afghanistan. This is not Iraq, so this is right after September 11th. I initially voted no on that because I just didn't trust them to handle that well. And my staff, before the end of the roll was called, prevailed on me to change my vote. And only one member of Congress of all 535 of us voted no on Afghanistan. And that was
Barbara Lee.
Yeah. And so it was the mood. That was a big part of it, the anger. People weren't thinking, as you said, Mr. Congressman Wexler, smart man, believed the hype. You just couldn't trust these people. That's the bottom line. And so many good lawyers in the Congress just failed because the legal case was never solid. There was never any real evidence. There was a lot of talk. But Saddam Hussein was not a threat. He never was.
There's still quite a lot of talk on both sides of the aisle of, well, Afghanistan was the good war, Iraq was the bad war. We should move the whole war to Afghanistan. Do you think that the Congresswoman Lee made the right vote in voting against the authorization to attack Afghanistan?
That's a good question. The key is in who is in charge of the war. And she, as I did, just did not trust these two people. And I think in that sense, it was a good vote because they quickly, it was days after Afghanistan where they started to talk about Iraq. It wasn't long. And Saddam Hussein. And so in that sense, if we had said no right off the bat to Afghanistan and maybe had Congress have a stronger role in how we respond to this, despicable act on September 11th, maybe we'd be better off today.
I couldn't agree more. One of the reasons that you give for being reluctant to trust President George W. Bush was an account of your first meeting with him, at which he seemed something less than presidential. Can you describe what that meeting was like?
Yes, when they came in, my father had served in the Senate with the first Bush, and I knew the new president's brother, Jeb, who became governor of Florida. And so I felt a little badly right off the bat going against his big agenda, the tax cuts. And at the conclusion of the vote, by then Jeffords had left the party, and the Washington was in turmoil. This was before September 11th. I called up the White House and said I'd like a meeting with the president just to break bread. And we didn't know each other very well. And so it's just the two of us in the Oval Office in June of 2001, early in June of 2001. And we did our pleasantries. And then I started talking about where he's taking the country. And it turned into a little bit of a confrontational exchange. I couldn't have a civil exchange about where you're taking the country. You said you're not going to be a divider, and yet here we are talking about abortion and big tax cuts and all these divisive issues. No matter how you might feel about them, they are indisputably divisive. And it just got confrontational. And after I left the Oval Office, I was staggered. I couldn't have a good conversation with the gentleman. And I tried to figure out what it was about him that unsettled me, and I came up with the word unpresidential. I couldn't have a civil conversation with him, and I didn't think that was presidential.
In your account in your book, he repeatedly is asserting and reminding, I'm the commander-in-chief, I'm the president, I'm the commander-in-chief, and you write that you know, I have been around people who are good at wielding power, and they never have to tell you they're in charge, they just are, and you know it. This guy was not presidential. That comes through in public, at least over the past several years, it has. I'm the decider. I'm in charge. He seems to be eternally that way. That
it's an insecurity or something, isn't it?
You
don't have to keep telling me that, I said to myself. I know who you are. I'm in the Oval Office.
We have questions for you piling up by email. We have a chat room where people send in questions. And if you want to do that and you're listening, you can go to thepeoplespeakradio.net and send in your question for former Senator Lincoln Chafee. And if you want to call in on the phone, it's 888-228-4494. Here's an interesting question from Mike in California. Do you believe George Bush is the worst president in U.S. history, and do you believe the Iraq War is the worst foreign tragedy in U.S. history?
I think history will agree with me, yes, on both. That America, at the moment when they came into office, and I tell the story in the book of a joint session of Congress where the Prime Minister of Italy, and this is in 2006 or something, Silvio Berlusconi, he's back in office in Italy now, was talking about a moment when he was hosting the G8 summit in Genoa, Italy, in it, and this was in March of 2001. He's telling us the story years later in a joint session in Congress. I'm sitting in my chair listening to him, and he's talking about hosting the G8 summit, and at the end of the meetings, there were Kazumi of Japan laughing with Blair of England. There was Putin of Russia chatting in friendly fashion with Bush. There was Schroeder from Germany. All the adversaries in one room, happy and laughing and having a good time. And Berlusconi said, an age of lasting peace beckoned. That's the way he described it. And then he went on to say, what a peaceful world we were handing to our children. And that's exactly the moment that I felt we had when Bush Cheney came in. That's March of 2001 when Berlusconi's describing that G8 meeting. An age of lasting peace beckoned. What a peaceful world we were handing to our children. And they squandered it. They squandered it in such reckless fashion. Both that peaceful world and, as I talked about earlier, those hard-fought surpluses. And so, yes, they've done tremendous damage to the United States, I think. And the war in Iraq, there's no easy answers now. The world hates us over this unnecessary and immoral war. And there's no easy answers on how we deal with it. So I'm a big fan of the bumper sticker 12009. Can't come soon enough.
It can't, and impeachment would be even better. And Berlusconi may have seen peace coming, and yet he fully supported the invasion and the occupation of Iraq against the overwhelming will of the Italian people, which is part of why he was out of office for a while. And part of why he's back is the lack of organization on the left in Italy. And we have that same problem here.
I'll agree with you on that, David. And you went on afterwards after describing that to say, but then September 11th happened. But at least he got that moment right. Because that's certainly the way I felt. An age of lasting peace beckoned, and a peaceful world we're handing to our children. And he put his hand over his heart. It was very emotional when he said it. So at least he did have that right.
Yes, he just accepted that September 11th changed everything in a particular way.
Which I don't agree with.
Yes, and that's very rare.
It shouldn't have.
But
your point about the left also, you're making the point that in Italy the left is in disarray, and that's a potential here you're going to offer that.
I was going to ask you, because you sort of close your book with a closing chapter where you make a plea for a center movement, even a third party that would find the center in the United States and argue that that's what the people need. And I have to, as someone who is openly from the left, I have to wonder about that, because I'm incredibly disappointed with the Democrats, who were elected in 2006 when you were unelected, to reverse course and have kept full speed ahead and have reversed almost nothing. And so in my analysis, we have a public in America that wants withdrawal, wants peace, wants impeachment, wants single-payer health care, wants fair taxation for corporations and the wealthy, wants to put money in human needs, in education, and the Democrats' positions, if not always their rhetoric, seem to me closer to the Republicans' positions than to the public's.
Yes, they're still cowering.
On war, we have a couple of Democratic nominees still. I mean, we can pretend there's still two of them, and one of whom refuses to forswear aggressive wars. The other one talks of obliterating entire nations. You know, if the center is going to be something to the right of that, I don't want any part of it. How do you see the Democrats as being too far to the left to begin with, and where do you see the center lying?
No, I'm saying that the Democrats are too much to the right, and that what you're saying is that most Americans feel this way. You just ticked off the litany of how Americans feel about getting out of the war and having peace and talking to some of our adversaries and having a health care plan, standing up for our liberties as outlined in the Constitution. There needs to be more power from the left. I think since I wrote that chapter and submitted to the publisher, the Obama campaign has come on and taken some of the legitimacy of that last chapter. If Obama's successful in the convention, then it makes that last chapter a little bit moot. But I submitted to the publisher the manuscript before the Obama campaign had really taken off.
And you talked in your book about beginning to wonder when you were still in Congress about whether you should stay with the Republican Party, and about one of the Republican leaders talking to you and convincing you to stay. Did any of the Democrats ever court you to try to convert you to their party?
Yes, but before I answer that, I will say, and I have some headlines that I tape in my office wall here, of since I was ousted from the Senate, what the Democratic majority has done, and one is, Senate urges Bush to declare Iran Guard a terrorist group. Remember that?
I do.
And it, what was it, 77-25 or something? 76-22. And in Senate, a White House victory on eavesdropping. This is all after the Democrats have the majority.
Oh, yeah, and they had it on that Iraq vote to begin with.
Yes.
They had a slim majority, but way back then.
Tom Daschle was majority leader, and then the FISA amendment. So the beat does just go on, and it's infuriating. And the fact that Senator Clinton can tout herself as a Democratic candidate, we've already had Kerry voted for the war, and John Edwards has supported the war. They just should be disqualified from leading this country. It was such a colossal error. But your question was more about did the Democrats ever ask me to cross the aisle? That happens all the time with the conversation going back and forth, whether it's a Zell Miller or John Breaux or Ben Nelson Democrats that the Republicans are talking to. Democrats are always talking to the Chafees and the Snows and the Collins. It's kind of chatter that goes on.
What about John McCain? There's a lot in the news lately of stories of how the Democrats were courting John McCain and how he told everyone he didn't vote for Bush. Did you have any insights into those accounts?
He was the other Republican that voted against the tax cuts, which surprised me because he hadn't supported any of the earlier amendments trying to scale back the tax cut. But when they called the roll, it was just he and I with only two Republicans to say no. A big shock. Not Jeffords, not Snow, not Collins, not Specter. McCain and Chafee. So he's just hard to pin down. Then he'll go to the convention in 2004 in New York and give the president a big sloppy kiss. He's hard to figure.
Do you know anything about Democrats trying to court him in those early years of this decade?
I would assume they were, but I think that if he wanted to leave the Republican Party, he would have done it after losing the primaries in 2000. There was a lot of independents that liked John McCain. If he had run as an independent in 2000, he could have really made a difference. Don't you agree?
Yes, absolutely. He could have.
Because the primaries he lost were the closed primaries, where only Republicans were allowed to vote. In states like Michigan, where independents can come in, and New Hampshire, where independents can come into a Republican, he won all those primaries.
So that was
his moment. If he wanted to switch, that was his moment.
Yeah, I hope that was his moment, and the coming year is not his moment. And I want to talk about the election, and I want to talk about a lot of other things in your book, but we have to take a quick break. This is the People Speak Radio at thepeoplespeakradio.net. When we come back, you can join us with your phone calls at 888-228-4494. That's toll-free. We will be back with former Senator from Rhode Island, Lincoln Chafee. This is your host, David Swanson. Back after this.
More than 1 million children are forced into prostitution every year because of sex tourism. Morocco has become a favorite destination. Economic difficulties contribute to the alarming growth of this industry. SOS Morocco's mission is to let the world know that it's against the law, a human and moral crime to travel to Morocco with the intent to engage in sexual activity with a child. Please visit SOSMorocco.org for more information and to support our endeavors.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
This is Gore Vidal. Can you name the one country on earth where the government can steal elections, strip away basic rights, spy on civilians, launch wars based on lies, and where the people do not take over the nation's capital in protest? If you said the United States, you'd be right. So let's remedy that by calling our Congress members and asking them to support the impeachment of George Bush and Dick Cheney. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
This land is yours.
Join us on the People Speak radio show every Tuesday and Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern for an hour of live interview and audience interaction with guests from the realms of entertainment, education, activism, spirituality, politics, and literature. Get involved and make a difference for the better. That's the People Speak every Tuesday and Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio Network.
And we are back at the People Speak Radio. This is David Swanson, your host, and our guest is former senator from Rhode Island, Republican, former Republican, Lincoln Chafee, whose book, brand new autobiographical book, is excellent, and it is Against the Tide, How a Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President. And we have a backlog of questions coming in by email, and we have some callers. Let's bring Susan on the line. Susan, thanks for calling the People Speak Radio.
I'm calling with a question for Lincoln Chafee about impeachment. He supported the idea of waiting until 2009, January 2009, and hopefully Obama would be president. But I'm concerned about the precedent that this administration has set. And wouldn't impeachment still be the best way to go? And if it's nonpartisan, I've set up a website, Republicans for Impeachment, and have had a tremendous response from the Republican voters. Wouldn't that open up the avenue for impeachment?
Good question.
I'd agree that constitutionally it's very, very valid. High crimes and misdemeanors, does that fit or doesn't it? And then it just becomes a practical exercise of, as we said earlier, the two of them really, you can't impeach one without the other, and I believe they're separate trials, first an impeachment of both of them in the House, then separate trials, and then you to Nancy Pelosi, is that right, for president? And unfortunately, it's a practical, and then counting the votes, trying to make a guess, is it as to whether it's all worth it in this polarized climate we're in, you could make the argument a crime's a crime, and no matter whether you get a conviction or not, you should have a trial. And I could understand that argument.
Well, You're the senator, so tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems like the Pelosi becomes president is sort of the cartoon version of this, where you would impeach both Cheney and Bush and convict them both simultaneously and by surprise in the Senate, because otherwise you have more of a Gerald Ford scenario play out. When Agnew was gone, Nixon wasn't gone in the same instant by surprise. You know, these happen sequentially, and so if Cheney were impeached, you know, that would set a precedent, as I think the caller was suggesting. But if he were actually removed from office, wouldn't he have to be replaced with someone nominated by the president and approved by both houses? And then couldn't the president be impeached? I mean, isn't it pretty unlikely that Nancy Pelosi actually finds herself in the Oval Office?
I follow you there, and I'm sure that a lot of people are hoping that would happen, first impeach the vice president, and then the battle would be on as to who would be confirmed by Congress, by the Senate. Is that right?
Well, it's both houses by the 25th Amendment have to approve, so they approved Ford, and I think there were some lesser candidates they would not have approved.
Yes. Where was Nelson Rockefeller in that mix? He was vice president for a while. But the 25th Amendment, this country is so polarized. You're down in Charlottesville. I mean, you know as well as anybody how divided this country is. And even to force the president to get an acceptable vice president, should Cheney be impeached, it would be very, very difficult. The Bill O'Reillys of the world and the Little Rush Limbaughs, and they still make money. Who's that horrible woman, Ann Coulter, or whatever her name is?
Yes. I agree it would be horrible, although I think living through what we're living through right now is perhaps just as horrible. So I think sometimes impeachment is seen as the crisis, whereas the Constitution meant it to be a cure for a crisis. So I don't know, but I do know that Bill O'Reilly would throw a fit. Let me ask you somewhat.
You'd make a lot of money. That would be the worst thing.
Well, that's what they're keeping.
And that's all he cares about.
That may be what they're keeping Senator Clinton around for, too, in this campaign. Let me ask you a question that came in by email from Elaine in Georgia. Do you feel that Hillary Clinton should drop out of the race, and do you feel she would make a good vice president with Barack Obama as president?
I don't think she should have ever run for president because she voted for the war. And there were two votes that day in October of 2002. The Levin Amendment. Carl Levin was chairman of the Armed Services Committee, and he offered an amendment just to slow it down. Just to slow it down. There were two votes, the Levin Amendment and then the authorization to go to war. And the Levin Amendment, all it said was let the inspectors do their work. Let them finish doing their work. So Hans Blix and those people. Let's work with the UN Security Council. And we'll meet within 24 hours if any new information comes up. Senator Clinton voted against Levin and then for the war. And she has no argument as to how she could ever vote against Levin. She shouldn't even be in the running, never mind dropping out.
This was the worst decision collectively,
as we said earlier, in American history.
Yeah, and the Democrats ran candidates in the last primaries and nominated a candidate last time around who voted for the thing and come very, very close to doing it again this time.
Yeah, they're all making all the people that had personal ambitions were voting aye. So anybody that wanted to run for president, that's Edwards, that's Kerry, that's Clinton, all of them, they were all voting
right.
aye, and those were the leaders. They were thinking of themselves first, the country
right.
second.
That's right, and the media pundits, knowing everything as they always do, were swearing that you could never run for president if you didn't vote aye. Of course, they had it upside down, but that's what they were instructing. Here's a little bit different topic come in from Tom in Canada. Where do you see the U.S. economy in November, and how do you think it will affect the election?
Good question, Tom in Canada. It's hard to predict. It's hard to predict with oil climbing, the gas prices at the pump climbing, and the squeeze on the middle class just getting more and more constricting, the cost of higher education, everything just getting more and more difficult for our bus middle class here, and the social services getting cut. When do they rebel? when does the outrage happen? And it is all tied to the economy, and I do think that if the case can be made that the trillions of dollars we're spending in Iraq are hurting our economy, maybe finally then it'll sink in and there will be some outrage.
Do you think that Senator Obama will get us out of Iraq if he becomes president?
I do. I think that he has the best chance to work with our allies around the world and try and bring some sanity to our relationships with our neighbors around the world and dealing with the Middle East in a broad and collective way, all the issues in the Middle East. I think he can do that.
Yeah, there's some interesting accounts in your book of the Bush administration's really opposition to achieving peace in the Middle East and relationships with countries like Cuba, where you have a conversation in the book with Fidel Castro, who essentially admits that he approves of the embargo because it allows him to make an enemy of the United States. You have accounts of meeting with Hugo Chavez and the Bush administration's demonization of him. How would you change our relationships around the world from what we've seen the past 7 years?
Well, you do mention the peace in the Middle East. I do think that's important, the peace between the Palestinians and Israelis, and that just reverberates through the Arab and Muslim world. And we have to just make a better effort at it. And as you said earlier, and I have this in my, I think it's chapter 18 in the book, that the president says he's in favor of peace between the Israelis and Palestinians, but does absolutely nothing about it. And he keeps using the words and misleading our friends in the region on this topic and doing absolutely nothing about it. And at the same time, making enemies such as Chavez unnecessarily. I met with President Chavez. He doesn't want an adversarial relationship with the United States, but with all the saber rattling, he starts the insults back, and it escalates. And now we're not talking to them and talking about making them terrorists and the like. It's nonsense in this age of nuclear weapons. We can't afford to have this escalation of first rhetoric and then arms races in an age of nuclear weapons.
Well, apparently much of the public is inclined to agree with you here and around the world, and the current president and vice president are now the least popular on record since polls have been done. It looked like in the 2006 elections that the greatest liability was being a Republican, being a member of the same party as Cheney and Bush. Is that basically why you lost in 2006?
Yes, without a doubt. And I'm living in Rhode Island, and that day doesn't go by where people don't apologize and say, I'm sorry I had to vote against you, but I wanted to change the Senate. And my opponent ran strictly on that. So I understood, too. I knew my options. I could leave the Republican Party, but at the same time, I knew there were prior to my run for re-election, but I knew we had a big highway bill coming up. I knew we had the military base closure bill coming up, and Republican controlled the White House, the Senate, and the House. There would have been retribution against Rhode Island, so I was in a no-win position, and I gave it my best shot, and I understood when the voters voted me out.
And we have about a minute.
The sad thing is, David, they got their Democratic Senate, and the Democratic Senate has been wimps.
That's the sad thing.
I got my unemployment papers, and nothing's changed.
nothing's changed in the House either, and I don't know what it would take for things to change, but obviously that wasn't enough, that landslide. We've got about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you, in the book you recount that in 2003, 2004, you actually considered challenging the president in the Republican primaries and running for president, and you backed off because of the timing of the capture of Saddam Hussein. Is running for president something you would ever consider again in your life?
Well, I think if somebody's not raising a debate that needs to be had, there's a certain responsibility that for any citizen to bring that, to have that debate, and that's why I considered it. Here I was a first-termer in the Senate, but my Republican Party was changing so drastically. I thought we should have a debate about that. Is this where we want to go? We're getting rid of our fiscal responsibility. We're getting into overseas entanglements. We're cutting our personal liberties. We're not caring about the environment. Is that where the Republican Party, where we want to go? So I thought that would be a good debate to have with the president, whoever made it. And since no one else was, I was thinking about it. But the as you said, the capture of Saddam Hussein and different things were just made it almost impossible to be more than a laughing, I guess, a joke candidate. I had to be smart about making a good decision.
Understood. And we are out of time, but it looks to me like the Republican Party as a mainstream force in this country began and ended with a Lincoln, and we have been speaking with perhaps the last sane Republican member of the Senate, we shall see, former Senator Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island, whose wonderful new book is Against the Tide, and the subtitle is How a Compliant Congress Empowered a Reckless President. I highly recommend it. Senator, thank you very much for the time this evening.
Thank you, David, for having me on the show, and thank you, listeners and the people that emailed in. I'm very grateful for them tuning in.
Our pleasure. And this is The People Speak Radio. We are at thepeoplespeakradio.net. We live and breathe on your donations, so go there and contribute if you like this show and others. Tomorrow evening, I'll be interviewing Cindy Sheehan, well-known peace activist who is running for Congress against Nancy Pelosi as an independent in San Francisco. Next Tuesday evening, Jason Lemieux, who is a board member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. And next Wednesday evening, Mary Pallant, who is running for Congress as a Democrat in Southern California. Please join us for those shows. Thanks for being with us at the People Speak Radio.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the city wall, by the relief of death, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering where this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is mine, there, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest, to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is mine.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.